This is our number two.
It's time for the fastest 15 minutes in the news. This is Dory's Fastest 15.
That's a world of news in a tidy little 15-minute package just for you. Welcome to our Fastest 15. Hey, SeaTac Airport, you got a pest problem? I got your pest solution. Mathis Exterminator, give him a call. You know what's so creepy about that? My wife and I took a long weekend last weekend. Right. We flew out of SeaTac. We sat and got something to eat. And I'm thinking, if there are rats running around everywhere.
Apparently it's not bad enough to shut down any restaurants or anything like that. But there's a lot of construction going on over there.
Oh, there is. I remember one time, this ticked me off. It ruined a meal. I was back in New York. We were covering the Mariners. I was doing my show from Yankee Stadium. And New York Vinny was working here.
Mm-hmm.
And so Vinny and I, we had a free night. And we said, let's go down to Little Italy. And, you know, Vinny, he's a New York guy.
Oh, yeah, former New York cabbie.
Yeah, so I want to hang out with Vinny down in Little Italy, of all places. Vinny Ricchici. Have you ever seen the clip of him on Name That Tune, by the way?
No.
I just rewatched it. a few days ago.
Funny you mention him because I believe it's his birthday today.
How in the world would you know that?
Because I'm Facebook friends.
Is that a Facebook thing? That's a Facebook thing. I forgot about Facebook.
Yeah, I'm friends with Vinny.
Everybody's friends with him. But yeah, no, he was really young. He was like, they introduced him as an insurance salesman or something. He comes out, it's the whole half hour of an episode of Name That Tune with Vinny Ricchici.
I love it.
But anyway, so we're sitting at this restaurant in Little Italy. And I get a Diet Coke with my meal. And he goes, oh, you don't want to do that. You don't want to do that here. I go, I'm horrible at doing New York Italian accent.
Yeah.
That might have been the worst New York Italian accent in radio history. But he goes, oh, those just sit up on a shelf and the rats are running all over those cans all day, every day.
Ooh.
And I'm thinking, I got a soda in front of me here. Why are you doing this? Ruining my meal like
that.
Yeah, I didn't get that.
No, it was nice of him, though.
Trying to protect me?
Yes.
Maybe.
You'd rather him just let you drink that Coke?
I did drink it. I'm fine today.
Ugh.
Or maybe that's the source of my problems today. I don't know what. Okay, let's get to the Fastest 15 here. As you just heard in Ursula's newscast, taxpayers down in Pierce County, they voted no on Sound Transit as a county. They are getting almost zero benefits, and they're being taxed illegally like everybody else in the taxing district. King and Snohomish were being illegally taxed as well. So a judge down there said, Sound Transit can continue to illegally tax you, to overvalue your vehicles, to overcollect a tax. And that, what was the quote? That the judge said it was above her pay grade?
This might be above my pay grade. I mean, the whole thing, just to even try to follow it, I had to read it, actually, three times just to try to follow this whole thing.
I can follow it.
Yeah, so I'll
boil
it
down. Sound Transit's trying to screw us over. They're doing it illegally. And a judge, any judge, should be able to figure that out.
Okay, I got that part.
There's a summation.
At least just trying to, yeah.
So,
depending on what side you would be on, yes.
Hannah asked Jeff Patrick from Sound Transit whether you and I, the voter, should trust them.
A lot of people didn't want this. A lot of people don't trust Sound Transit. And when you say things like that, which I understand the construction costs, what do you say to those voters who don't trust you?
Well, in a region like ours that's growing so fast and where congestion's already bad, and it's just like many other urban areas across not only the nation but the world, you reach a point where if you want to add transportation capacity, your only real choice is to do it by developing mass transit. So these are investments that have been long delayed and that we're now finally moving forward with. And
this is so infuriating. Long delayed. Yeah, they were a decade behind schedule on phase one. Oh, we'll do a reset. Now we're on time and on schedule. Long delayed. Long delayed because of their criminal corruption within this agency. Billions and billions, tens of billions of dollars over budget. Every family in the taxing district over a 30-year period will be paying six figures to this agency. Six figures. It is the most criminally corrupt agency in the history of the United, public agency in the history of the United States of America.
So these are investments that are going to benefit everybody in the region, whether or not they ride the surfaces or not. Every person who climbs aboard one of our trains or one of our bus rapid transit runs is someone who's not going
to
be out of.
I've been listening to this crap for 22 years from Sound Transit. That's enough of that. Okay,
she
next.
She asked him the question again. She pushed him on
end?
It. That's why.
So I should listen to the end of it?
Yes.
Okay. We just got this audio in. I didn't have a chance to preview it.
To rising congestion as we continue to see population growth in our region.
Should the voters trust Sound Transit?
Sound Transit is out there every single day working to move thousands of people, get them where they need to go. And we're also committed to delivering the projects that the voters approved on the schedules they approved.
So two things.
That's a no.
Number one, good for Hannah. Great job by Hannah to ask the question in the first place. And then when the guy gives his 50-second canned spiel PR nonsense, then she asks it again. Now, if you're the Sound Transit spokesperson, shouldn't you, if you're not a criminally corrupt agency, when she's asked it again, that's great.
Continue to see population growth in our region.
Should the voters trust Sound Transit?
Now, if you're not the spokesman for a criminally corrupt agency, you would say, yes, the voters can trust us. But instead, he gives us this load of garbage.
Sound Transit is out there every single day working to move thousands of people, get them where they need to go. And we're also committed to delivering the projects that the voters approved on the schedules they approved.
You know, gosh, I'm glad you had me play the rest of that.
Yeah.
Nice job, Nicole.
Hey, thanks.
Nice job, Hannah. Nice job, Nicole. You're all the ones who make me look okay. I'm serious. Is that about as damning an indictment as you're going to hear? That the spokesman for Sound Transit cannot say yes to the question, can the voters trust you? He couldn't say. He had two chances. And
it seemed like an easy yes-no question.
It's a very easy yes, you can trust us. Why in the world would he do that? He's so used to being a weasel. Oh, okay, that made my afternoon. No, it's like number three on my list of afternoon highlights.
You told me that an upcoming interview might be one that your favorite that you've ever done.
Yeah, I'll preview it again. Between 1:30 and 2 o'clock, it's, I don't know if it's number one, but it's one of the top three stories we have ever shared on the show.
The story is incredibly heartwarming,
it's,
for sure.
Yes. Do not miss between 1:30 and 2 o'clock this afternoon. Next up in the Fastest 15... Have you been following this absolute meltdown of Tesla founder Elon Musk?
Yes.
This is. I saw somebody Twitter this morning.
This, remember we were talking about, does money buy happiness?
Wow. Somebody on Twitter this morning said, this is pretty amazing to watch Elon Musk turn into Howard Hughes before our eyes. He's going insane. He's going insane. So all the Tesla top executives are bailing. The stock price is plummeting. Elon Musk went on the Joe Rogan podcast. He is smoking a joint and drinking whiskey while doing this podcast. And, you know, this one, his eyes are all squinty and he's just, you know, in that haze, that weed haze. And he's kind of tippling around in his chair.
How does that work? Do people get upset at you if you do certain things? There's tobacco and marijuana in there. That's all it is.
That is bad.
The combination of tobacco and marijuana is wonderful.
And
he just wouldn't talk.
Tesla was, drunk and high.
Yeah, the stock has gone down over 6% today.
Yeah, it's, man, I would not want, if this guy's in charge of the company, you invest in people when you invest. And if you've got a stark raving madman, he's going to be walking around with tissue boxes for shoes before you know it, like Howard Hughes did. Man, I would have loved to.
Well, you know, he recently was in the news because he was talking about making the company go private. Yeah. And then his chief accounting officer quit after a month.
Yeah, he's going to grow his fingernails out to 4 inches before we know it, like Howard Hughes. Shuffling around in a Vegas suite.
Okay, I feel sorry, though. I'll be honest.
For Elon Musk?
Someone's just having a meltdown. I mean, seriously.
Next up in the Fastest 15, as you know, I am an objective journalist, and I don't like giving my opinion on any of the stories that we talk about on the air. But sometimes, occasionally, I see a story that almost demands me breaking out of my journalist bubble and interjecting an opinion. And today's edition of News and Comment is...
Now it's time for News and Comment, where we go beyond the headlines and bring you perspective and analysis of today's biggest news stories. First, the news.
And this is a local story. This is from Kennewick, Washington, where, and it, this is a bit sensitive if you want to...
If you have kids in the car.
If you have kids in the car, you're probably not going to want to listen for the next 2 minutes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Kennewick, Washington. Kennewick police have arrested a 35-year-old man after he was caught sexually assaulting an injured beaver in a park. According to a news release posted on the Kennewick Police Department's official Facebook page, this happened late Monday evening. Police officers responded to Columbia Park for a report of a transient male having sexual contact with the injured beaver. Officers contacted 35-year-old Richard Delp and arrested him on charges of first-degree animal cruelty and possession of meth. During the course of the investigation, officers learned that a woman in the park witnessed the beaver get struck by a car. The animal was still alive and appeared to have two broken legs. In an attempt to help the injured beaver, the woman wrapped it in a towel and went to her nearby home to retrieve a bin to put the beaver in so she could figure out what to do with it. The woman said she called many places to find someone to take the injured beaver before she headed back to the park. When she got back to the park a short time later, she saw the man lying on top of the beaver. At first, she thought the man was trying to help the animal. As the man rolled over, she was horrified to find the beaver was on its back. She had left it on its stomach. And the man's pants were unzipped, unbuttoned, and unbuckled. When she asked what he did to him, the man replied, "It's not a him, it's a her." The woman said she called the man out on what he was doing to the animal, and he replied, "It's just a beaver." The woman called Kennewick police. They responded to the park. They arrested the man after he admitted to sexually assaulting the animal.
And now, the comment.
I thought this sort of thing was going to stop in Trump's America.
This has been News and Comment. The views expressed in News and Comment are those of Dory Monson and do not necessarily reflect the views of Cairo Radio.
The man is currently being held without bail in the jail there. Next up in the Fastest 15... Speaking of which, I saw this interesting column. It's slate.com. That's where I get all my news.
I was going to say.
I go to Slate. But as you know, I went to Ballard High School.
Mm-hmm.
You know the Ballard High School mascot?
Sure.
What is it?
The Friendly Beavers.
It's the Beavers, which is why we would walk around as Ballard High School students proudly singing, "Oh, I'm a beaver, you're a beaver, we're beavers all, and when we get together, we do our beaver call." That was our fight song.
That sound effect was not part of it. That was just your...
No, and you did the little fingers next to your mouth like you're doing the little beaver thing. Maybe that's why our sports teams never did very well. That was our fight song. Anyway, at Slate.com, they have this story headlined, "Forget the bison. The beaver has a uniquely American spirit, and it's about time we made the beaver America's national mammal." And that made me think, what would, because I think that's great. Beavers are industrious. They're nature's engineers, you know.
They're awfully cute.
They're cute as a button. And, but they just, they're diligent. They work. They, I mean, the dams, they build dams. They're beavers and they build dams. Yes, they should be America's national mammal. And I probably will get to this next week. What should Seattle's city mammal be? What would be the animal that would best represent the deep depths to which our city has fallen? Or the soaring heights, if you disagree with me. Send me a text on the Online Trading Academy text line at 98973. That's 98973. What should Seattle's city mammal be? And that is your Fastest 15.
This has been the Fastest 15 Minutes of the News. Fast. Dory's Fastest 15.
Okay, Ursula's going to check the news, and then we're going to share a story with you that I think is one of the most remarkable we've ever told on the air. And it's coming up next. Well, I have pretty remarkable story to share with you. I've told you guys, I pretty much grew up without a dad. And I'm always intrigued with these stories of guys who grow up without a father mentor in their life. And this is the story about a kid who was born in 1972 to a single mom, not just a single mom, but a 16-year-old mom, Carol Briggs. And she told ESPN E60 about giving birth at age 16.
Well, I explained to him, you know, that me and his father were not, we weren't the love story that he might have been hoping for. You know, we were young. I was 16, he was 18.
How did you tell the father of the baby about his son?
I didn't tell anybody anything. I didn't tell anyone anything. My mom found out I was pregnant. It was handled a little differently back then. And less than a week, I was gone. She sent me to this place in Pittsburgh. And I didn't come home until the day after Dylan was born.
And so the 16-year-old girl gave her baby, who she named John, up for adoption. And the baby John was adopted by a doctor and his wife. And they named him D-Land, as you just heard the mom say. And he grew up to be a fine young man, a fine athlete. But the adoptive family, the dad of that family, moved out when he was 2 years old. So he didn't have a biological dad. He didn't really have an adoptive dad in his life. But he still grew up to be a fine man. Went to high school, became a terrific football player, and that's when he attracted the attention of some college coaches. And one of those college coaches is a guy that, man, I watched all the time in the earliest years of the Seahawks and, of course, covered the team when Sherman Smith was the running backs coach. And the Seahawk legend, Sherman Smith, joins us here on Cairo Radio. Hey, Sherman, great to talk with you, sir.
Good to talk to you. How you been?
I've been fantastic. It's really great to have you on again. So I'm fascinated by this story, Sherman, because you were a running back coach at Miami of Ohio, and you went to recruit this 16-year-old high school kid who grew up without a biological dad, grew up without an adoptive dad named D-Land. Why were you interested in this kid?
Well, you know, he was talented. I believe his senior year in high school, he rushed for 1,500 yards. And at Miami of Ohio, we were just looking for good football players. And Campbell, Ohio was one of my recruiting areas that I had the responsibility of checking out. And Dylan just was one of those guys that just stood out that I thought he would help us become a better team at Miami of Ohio.
And I hear that some of the other coaches wanted to have him switch positions. But he had really bonded with you, and he said, I'll take a redshirt year if I can play running back for Coach Sherman Smith, right?
Yeah. We brought him in, and, you know, guys loved him, you know, his athleticism, thought he could be a wide receiver, could be a defensive back. But, you know, I had recruited him as a running back,
yeah.
And, you know, and he wanted that chance. And so Randy Walker was gracious enough to say, okay, you know, we'll redshirt you, and then, you know, we'll give you a chance to play running back. And I don't think they have any regrets because of the type of career that he had his 4 years there.
You have coached, you know, several hundred kids over your life. What made D-Land special, and why did you bond with him so?
Well, I just think, you know, when I first started to recruit him, you could just see he was serious. I mean, he was a yes sir, no sir guy, and you know, I think he had an idea of what he wanted to try to accomplish in his life, and so I just loved his seriousness, the intensity about how he went about things. And when he got on campus, you know, his seriousness about his books and training and trying to get better. And so this was a young man that acted a lot more mature than his chronological years. You know, he acted like a grown man. So he acted like a guy that had, you know, been through some things, that had, you know, had a tough childhood, and so he appreciated the opportunity, and each and every day he went out and he just worked hard every day.
And like I said, this is a kid who grew up without a dad, and I saw a quote from you, Sherman, where you said, you tell your players, I'm going to treat all of you like my son. And it sounds like that's something that the D-Land especially needed in his life.
Yeah, you know, and that was something that I always said to my players, even when I started coaching high school at Redmond High School. That was the thing I said. I told the guys, I'm old enough to be your father, and you may not be looking for a father, but I'm going to treat you like you're my sons. And that's just how I looked at all the guys, you know. And so each and every guy, they were different to me, but, you know, they were like a son to me. And that gave me the freedom to be able to speak to them about more things than just football. So we could talk about life and other things. And so we just had those kind of relationships. So with Dylan, you know, the fact that he may have been looking for a father and didn't have that father figure, he gravitated toward that. And I told people, I didn't treat him any differently than I treated anyone else.
Yeah.
I hope I treated all the guys the same way. And so we just bonded and it just remained to this very day.
And you left, you were climbing the coaching ladder. So after, I think, a year together at Miami of Ohio, you left to go to Illinois. He stayed at Miami, but he'd taken a special interest in this kid, and you certainly followed along as he had this great college career, right?
Yes. We stayed in contact, and, you know, I continued to see how he was doing, and he had a great career. He's a Hall of Famer. He broke records, rushing records at Miami, and proceeded to, you know, get an opportunity to coach, to play in the NFL, but that was a shortcut because of a knee injury. And, you know, then he proceeded on life after football, you know, finding a job and teaching and, you know, running a boarding home, and then also then getting back in the coaching himself, where his first coaching job was on the college level was at Miami, Ohio. So we just stayed in contact with each other throughout the years.
And since he wanted to follow kind of that same path that you'd been on, he stayed in touch with you. He sought you out as a coaching mentor as well?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we talked a lot of football, and particularly when he got into the coaching part of it, he was experiencing some things that I had already experienced. Plus, he was a running back coach, so we got a chance to talk about different techniques and thoughts about how to run plays, and it was really a lot of fun just interacting with each other in that manner.
And then when you were here coaching the running backs for the Seahawks, you brought D-Land out for a coaching internship with you too.
Yeah, he came out and did an internship that they have during the summer, the minority internship. So he came out, and I think he spent about a week because he had to get back to go to college. You know, Indiana was getting ready to start it up. And he just came in, and he did a great job. You know, so I gave him the responsibility of the individual period, because I really believe when those guys come out for that internship, they don't want to just come out there and hold dummies and, you know, and do grunt work. You know,
I wanted
him to get a chance to coach, you know, for it to be a good experience. Because I did two of those fellowships myself. And I remember one I didn't do anything but stand around. And it was, I gained some knowledge, but it wasn't the same as coaching. And then the next one, I got to coach more. And so I wanted to make sure that anyone that did an internship with me had that experience. And so Dylan did a lot of good things and showed himself to be a good coach.
So this kid who grew up without a biological dad, without an adoptive dad, you've been mentoring him his entire life. You didn't know that he was seeking out his biological parents. You had no idea that that was going on, I assume.
No, he never had that conversation with me saying, you know what, I'm starting the process to try to find my biological parents. So we never had that conversation.
And so D-Land is searching out his biological parents while you are still mentoring him. And that's when the story takes one of the most incredible turns I've ever heard in any story ever. Sherman, hold on. We'll finish telling the tale of the kid you were mentoring And we will continue our conversation with Seahawk legend Sherman Smith. You're not going to want to miss what's coming up here on the Dory Monson Show. Continuing our conversation with Seahawks legend Sherman Smith. And Sherman's been telling us about this kid that he started recruiting and coaching at age 16 named Dylan. And then Dylan pursued a coaching path that Sherman was on, and Sherm continued to mentor him for 28 years. But now a grown man, Dylan had kids of his own. Sherman had no idea that Dylan was, at the time, pursuing his biological parents. They unsealed adoption records. He tracked down his biological mom. And then from that ESPN E60 piece, here's what happened after he got hold of his biological mom.
I said, well, shoot, who's my dad?
And I said, well, your father's name is Sherman Smith.
Your dad is a man named Sherman Smith. And when she said that, I mean, it was, I almost fell off, almost like passed out.
And I could kind of hear him choke up a little. And he says, well, I've known Sherman my whole life.
It's like I couldn't even hear anything she was saying because I'm still processing. Your dad is a guy by the name of Sherman Smith. I knew exactly who, what. I'm like, this is unbelievable to me, you know.
This is one of the most incredible stories I've ever heard in my life, man. I mean, I got goosebumps knowing what was coming.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you.
You never knew. You never knew that 16-year-old Carol Briggs was pregnant, right?
No.
She'd never told you.
No, never told me.
And you'd gone off to college. You had a great 8-year NFL career. You married your college sweetheart, right?
Yes.
So what happens? So Dylan texted you and said, can you talk? I have something important. What did you think he was going to ask you about?
Well, you know, it was about a week or so, about 8 days before Thanksgiving. So it's that time of year when college coaches, because at that time, Dylan was coaching at USC. So it's that time when college coaches have an opportunity to move on, to go change jobs, you know. So that's what I thought it was in reference to. So when I called him back immediately because I said, man, let me get a hold of him. He might be in a position where he has to make a decision and he just wants to shoot some things by me. So I called him back that morning and we never got into that conversation. That's when he went into, you know, hey, you know, I'm adopted and, you know, and I began to search for my biological parents and, you know, and I'm excited for him. And he said, and I was able to get my birth certificate just the other day. And man, that's good to hear. And I found out who my biological mom was. Man, I'm excited for him, you know. And then when he said her name, my heart dropped because I knew Carol Briggs,
yeah.
You know, and I knew Carol Briggs in a manner of which, you know, that I shouldn't be surprised if he said, you know, hey, you're my father. So, you know, and so when he said it, he said, I asked her who was my dad, and she said, you. The same way that he said he felt when Carol told him I was his father, it was, you know, took his breath away. It was the same way I felt when he told me she said I was his father, you know. So
yeah.
I was surprised, you know, I was shocked, you know, I was, man, life, you know, it was like, boom, you know, I was glad I was sitting down because, you know, that's not what I expected to hear when we started our conversation morning.
Well, I mean, I just, like I said, this is so incredible that this kid you'd been mentoring for, by now, 28 years, but mm-hmm. it's also a bombshell in your life. You'd been married how long at that point?
Well, going on 42 years.
42 years with kids. So
yes.
What do you say to your wife and your kids?
Well, that was it. After, you know, when Dylan told me, you know, man, like he said in the E60 piece, I was mumbling and all stuff because, you know, I was like, man, trying to get myself together. So I told him, I said, Dylan, I need to process this. I'll call you back, you know. So
yeah.
I called him back a couple hours later because I was just thinking through this whole thing. And then the whole time I was thinking, man alive, the hardest conversation, you know, I needed to tell my wife and my kids. And it was like, so at that point, I had not talked to Carol. And at that point, I'm going along the assumption that I am his father, you know,
sure.
because we hadn't done a DNA test yet. So I'm just thinking along the lines that this is true. And so, and I need to tell my wife, but I was thinking I didn't want to tell her until we did a DNA test and I got the results. I didn't want to open up this can of worms if I didn't have to. So,
right.
But later on that night, I just couldn't, you know, it was just weighing on me because my first emotion, like I said, it was not about excitement. I was in shock and I was in pain. I was hurting because of this, because I was feeling bad about being so irresponsible. Like I have said, when you're 63, you see things differently than you do when you're 16 or 17 years old.
You think?
And I look back on this thing. Yeah. You know, and it just, the gravity of, my irresponsibility was just, you know, I could see it. I had coached guys that, you know, grew up in a home without their dad, and I saw some of the results and the struggles they went through. So, man, I was feeling bad that I had put him through that.
But you never knew she was pregnant.
I never knew.
Yeah.
No, I never knew. And I look at that and I say, okay, you know, you didn't know, but still, you know, and I'll be honest with you. I think if Carol had said something to me 45 years ago, you know, hey, Sherman, I gave birth to a child, your son, and I put him up for adoption, I would have said to her, you know, Carol, I'm glad that you're sure, but I need to be sure.
Right.
So, you know, where's he at? I'm not gonna run away from my responsibility, but you know, I want to be sure as sure as you are. So it really weighed on me, and I told my wife about it that evening, and she was awesome. She was upbeat. She knew dealing. She had loved dealing. She was crazy about dealing, and so that made it easier. And she just said, hey, if he's your son, he's your son, and we'll deal with it. And, you know, she's excited about the fact that we got four grandsons and, you know, another daughter-in-law. So my wife was and has been just upbeat about this from the beginning. And then talking to my kids, I talked to my daughter first because she lives in the Nashville area, and I talked to her. And it was a hard conversation. My daughter said, Dad, it's the first time I've seen you cry. Because when I told her, I was feeling so bad that I started crying.
Sure.
And so she was, she was great. She just said, Dad, you know, I always wanted an older brother. I'm good. And, you know, and so I can't wait to meet him. And then my son and my other three grandkids and my daughter-in-law came from North Carolina the day before Thanksgiving, which they hadn't planned on doing. But then for some reason they decided they were coming. So I waited till he got here, and I told him and my daughter-in-law and my son, Sherman, he was great also. Dad,
wow.
You know what? Man, that's I'm good. You know, he asked some questions, but he said, I'm good. I look forward to meeting him, you know. But my son was the same. Let's make sure that, you know, let's go through the DNA process and make sure so we don't all get excited for no reason.
Right.
So they were all good.
Unbelievable. What do you think threw you and Dylan together 28 years ago when neither of you knew the biological connection? Do you think there's some guiding hand there?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. You know, a lot of people that I know that say that they're not spiritual. They say they see divine intervention in here. And, you know, and since I'm a Christian, not afraid or ashamed to say it, I truly, as I look back on it now, I say, wow, God is just, you know, how this came together and how we stayed in contact. I just don't think that's a coincidence. I just see God's hand all in it, you know, and so I just see it. When we got together, it started. When I recruited him, I just so happened to living out in Seattle, Washington, living in Woodinville, coaching at Redmond High School, teaching at Redmond Junior High. And I go back to Miami of Ohio right when Dylan's, you know, getting ready to get recruited. And I recruit him,
yeah.
You know, and our relationship begins at that point and continues from that. So I don't think, you know, coincidence. I don't believe in that. So I say, yeah, God definitely, bless he and I with having that first conversation, and it continued throughout the years.
Yeah. Yeah. The kid who needed a father figure actually had his biological dad all along and just didn't know it. Sherman, it's one of the most remarkable stories I've ever heard. ESPN did a beautiful job telling it, and I wanted to share it with my listeners. I know what a mentor you've been to, like I said, hundreds of people. I know about the strength and longevity of your marriage and your family, and I'm honored that you can share the story on my show with me and with my listeners.
Well, I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to do it, and, you know, I'm thankful for the opportunity I have now to, you know, extend a relationship and grow a relationship with Dylan and with my four grandsons and my daughter-in-law. And so as a family, we feel so blessed.
Yes, and rightly so. Sherman, great talking with you. Thank you so much for your time, and really appreciate it.
Thank you, and go Hawk.
All right, Seahawk legend Sherman Smith joining us. Well, I'd love to hear your thoughts. The Online Trading Academy text line at 98973, and we have the big lead at 2 coming up next.